Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Context of white supremacy. Context of white supremacy. I'm just doing a quick sound check, so just making sure my audio isn't acting up. Is the audio all right? Okay, grand. Much obliged, Draftomania. Thank you. So we are about 5 minutes before we start the book club. The only reason I am going live early is... I do not have children. I say that all the time and pause. No caveats, nothing to qualify. So that's why I try not to get up here and pontificate as though I know, oh, this is what to do to raise children. I am totally clueless, totally ignorant, no expertise in that area at all. That being said, I do recognize that being an attentive parent is, wow, extremely grueling work. This is not related to the book club at all. That's why I'm doing it early. Extremely grueling. Being an attempted parent, that's part of the reason I do not have offspring. The system of racism, white supremacy being the primary reason I do not have offspring. However, I think it's cliche. They say sometimes your attempted parents, they will share something with you when you are a young person, and you won't appreciate that lesson until way later in life. Sometimes they'll say maybe you won't appreciate it until you have offspring yourself. One of those I can give credit to my attempted mother. Man, I used to, or yeah, this when I was a child, still not a man, I would run as soon as my mother would get home, or father, but particularly mother, because, you know, got to get something signed, permission slip, or, you know, whatever, something school related. You got to put your signature on it. So as soon as she opened the door, sprint right to the door. Mom, can you get this signed? Got to get this for school, going on a field trip or whatever. She'd be like, my gosh, can I get in the house? Can I get a foot inside before I am bombarded with requests? Like, you don't know what has happened. I could have just been in a car accident or anything. Like, can I just get a foot inside? And then, how was your day? How are you doing? You survived. Did anything racist happen to you? Oh, okay, great. Can you sign my... Oh, okay. And it took a while. I remember that was not a three... That was like a 10, 15 time type thing. But eventually... I did get it. Again, I don't have offspring, so I've not experienced that from a child of mine. However, I have experienced that from other people. Like, wow, especially when you have already had, like, incidents of racism or just, you know, the general strife of life. You could have hit a pothole or anything. And as soon as you step inside, being assaulted, like, and I will say, I have applied that. As a child, I absolutely nagged my mommy all the time with that. As an adult, I have applied that lesson and remembered, absolutely, how are you doing? How was your day? Are you all to check in? And then if you need a request or have something to get to, at least let the person breathe, decompress a little bit. We talk about that on workplace racism quite a bit. Whew, experienced that today. Wow. If you can at least let folks decompress when they arrive at the residence. System of white supremacy does a lot of traumatizing to black people. Sometimes you just need to get inside safely for a few minutes, and then you can, you know, deal with other matters. All righty. Paul Robeson, that is what we are doing. Book club. Man, I am chomping to talk about workplace. I wish it was the old format. We used to do workplace racism on Thursday. I wanted to share. I do think it's important to recognize sometimes just important lessons that Mr. Fuller does that as well, talking about some of the lessons. I think he shared one time that was how he came up with the 9 areas of people activity. His father, some of the lessons, things that his father had talked to him about, but neither here nor there. I was chomping at the bit to talk about workplace racism. That is on Fridays, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, so I will have to be patient. Workplace racism. I am going first tomorrow for workplace racism. Wow. Thankfully, nothing wacky happened. I was able to go and teach this morning. At 6 a.m., I can do my quick brag before we start our audio. To teach the 6 a.m. class, you have to be at the studio at 5:45 a.m., so you can imagine how early you have to be awake to do all of this. Woke up with no alarm today. I do not do that every day and was stunned myself, but I woke up, I rolled and looked at the clock. It was going to go off in 2 minutes. I said, wow, that did not mean it was going to be a great sign for a good Thursday, because it has not been in the context of white supremacy. We will get to Mr. Robeson, Dr. Gerald Horn. We actually have an interview with Paul Robeson, one of our listeners in Europe, no less, since Mr. Robeson spent a lot of his time there. One of our listeners in Europe sent this audio segment to me months before we started reading this book. And he said, wow, you should check this out. It is so constructive. You're just getting a snippet. This is like a 30-minute interview. It is on YouTube. I already did the setup for this. Yeah. Listen in. Paul Robeson, Context of White Supremacy, the book club.
In your book, Mr. Robeson, Here I Stand, you have a chapter entitled The Power of Negro Action.
That's right.
What are some of the specific acts which you recommend, and perhaps in the order of priority? Yeah.
Well, I say in any Negro life, you would say that nobody, this is, seems to be rather startling to many of my friends. Nobody would be startled, say, with taking the vote of the power of Italian action, or Polish action in Detroit, or Catholic action in New York, and so forth. I mean, that the vote would be a block, and the power of the Negro vote in the North in certain states. This is one very important aspect, very clear. A kind of we have tremendous economic power in this land today. There should be tremendous support of Negro business, of Negro banks and so forth, of loan associations and so forth. But the prime thing is that I'm convinced that
taking this last illustration of yours, have you not found that as Negro bankers become richer, that they grow away from your people?
No, I don't. Do they remain a part of total
Negro action?
There's no way for, as I said before, for any American Negro, however wealthy, however famous, to be anything at this period of our history at some point than an American Negro. If he doesn't know it, he'll find it out.
From a racial standpoint, yeah, Mr. Robeson, yeah. But from the political standpoint of socialism, which you were discussing a few moments ago, surely a Negro capitalist, if he had the opportunity, would undoubtedly behave according to the lights of his own.
He has to, but I know many of the most wealthy, and they often I feel that they don't help as much as they should. But he's forever conscious his children suffer the same things as the poor Negro's children, and at some point he finds a way to help. Mm-hmm. It's a little different even there. But that is
in other words, you feel it tracks through in a different way.
But I'm really not. What I'm trying to say is that. is that somewhere for our own dignity, I see, that is Africa, would you understand? Ghana today, unifying as a, with its own sort of, you know, nationalist strength. Is that clear?
Yes. Yeah.
I feel in America, strange to say, especially in the South, that even with all the goodwill of white liberals in the country, that it's very important for the Negro people to know what they want and to unify to do it. Often in a very simple case of fighting segregation, one group of Negroes can be drawn aside because of political pressure, other pressures. We should unify too. We should unify.
Yes,
I feel there's got to be a unity in order to integrate. That's what I feel. I feel that we just can't integrate as individuals.
Yes. But isn't the example of Liberia, for example, a sorry example, as it's set against Ghana?
Well, yes, because that's a very simple. The Firestone has taken care of that. It has been exploited to its hilt by Firestone rubber, if you don't know the facts.
Yes, right. It still remains, then, right. An economic
and
question.
And so has Ghana.
Rather than a racial unity question. It remains an economic question in its fundamentals rather than the
Ghana
unity of
also,
the Negro people.
Ghana has the unity of its own nation, same as Chinese or Indians, very close to India. India's just, they have a culture and a history that has its own national characteristics.
But what will prevent Ghana from becoming another Liberia?
That's the...
What do you mean?
Well, from because
Liberia
of the
today
pressures.
Is completely controlled by Firestone, not by Africans. But I feel that Nkrumah is going to control the economy of Ghana, and at some time be strong enough to say to the European, either you sit here and acknowledge that we run our own country, like Nehru, or else you go. But I don't see the day when Liberia can tell Firestone to do that. Oh, they're quite different. They're quite different. Liberia is a complete vassal state of American capital, finance capital, without question. They have nothing to say, nothing whatsoever.
What is your reaction to the passive resistance as practiced in Montgomery?
I think there was a magnificent movement, and nobody can, I say, there's nothing, as far as the general thing of a nonviolent solution of the problem, this is the, there could be no other solution within our, within the frame of things today. I mean, this is a very important contribution. Nobody could think of a violent solution unless somebody wanted to ask somebody to be destroyed. I mean, that would be absurd. On the other hand, within that framework, I think that the Negro people have to be extremely militant and demand a little more than they are demanding today, and to do a little more, to do other things as well as pray, let me put it, as well as pray.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, November 7, 2019. So I have been told. That was the late, great Paul Robeson, a 1958 interview with KPFA. One of our listeners in Europe shared that report with us a few months back, just before we started the book club on Dr. Gerald Horn's Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. This is our third segment. But that segment I thought was so brilliant for so many reasons. The suspected race soldiers at KPFA and the questions that they asked and trying to redirect away from racism, white supremacy. Oh, it's socialism. Oh, it's capitalism. Don't those no good Negroes capitalists, the Negro capitalist, doesn't he behave just like the white man and all that nonsense? And I loved the brilliance of Paul Robeson to redirect. Don't you think those no good Africans over in Liberia, don't you think they're doing the exact same thing? They're not unified. They say, whoa, 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 Mr. Robeson, stop, whoa, whoa, stop right there. Who is in charge in Liberia? Firestone, and specifically individuals classified as white who control, dominate, make up the board of Firestone. That's who is in charge. Brilliance. You can check out that interview. It's like 30 minutes long, but that was one of the highlights, I thought. We are in Chapter 3 of Dr. Horn's biography, about the midpoint. Retired firefighter is doing the heavy lifting of reading for us this week. I will turn it over to him. We'll get started. This is The Context of White Supremacy. Again, Dr. Gerald Horn's biography on the late, great Paul Robeson. Audio segment number 1.
The brief summary of the preceding paragraph hardly does justice to the depth and importance of the journey the Robesons took in the terms of both kilometers and ideological distance. For it was a transformative trip to Germany, then the Soviet Union, the two nations whose confrontation in the early 1940s shaped the contours of the planet that changed Robeson radically for all time. On the verge of this journey, the Robesons were residing comfortably at 19 Buckingham Street off the Strand, as their friend Marie Seton put it. Though perceived as a come-down from Hampstead, this London home may have been more in line with the Robesons' growing political engagement. The old stairs creaked when mounted to the top floor flats. One flat was too small for the Robeson family, so Essie's mother, Mama, lived with Polly in another, just across the landing. The flat, accompanied by Paul and Essie, had one bedroom, a living room, and a study, kitchen, and bathroom, befitting a man who spent a good deal of his waking hours immersed in language study and philology. The flat looked very much like the home of a London University professor, as it was lined with packed bookshelves, but also, as befits so many university professors, he was swimming in his studies, only occasionally emerging from his reasonably tranquil pool to emerge in other matters. But it was not just that the press of events was sufficiently intense to drive Robeson to deepen his already sprouting political commitments, but a number of personal encounters solidified this emerging trend. For at that moment, Jewish refugees were flooding into London, escaping the early ravages of fascism's spread on the continent. He was asked to perform at benefits for them, but according to Seton, his terse response was, "I'm an artist. I don't understand politics." But then he relented and his life was transformed as a partial result of these face-to-face encounters. "It was also during this time," he recalled reflectively, "when I was speaking at a meeting of intellectuals in London about the winter of 1933 or 34. And then a Negro man got up in the back of the hall and said, 'Why don't you stop all this nonsense? You intellectuals and princes' sons, don't you understand that the basic problem is the problem of the working class of Africa? That is, the ones who are exploited. So why don't you go to Africa? Especially, why don't you follow what's going on in the Soviet Union?'" Never to shrink and shuffle away in such a situation, Robeson said, "I accepted the challenge. And a couple of weeks later, I found myself in Moscow, where he bumped into Patterson. It was just before Christmas in 1934 that the Robesons, accompanied by Marie Seton, headed for Moscow with an intermediate stop in Germany. His German was fluent, which came in handy when he was menaced by stormtroopers at a train station. This German fluency evidently influenced his four-year-old son, who, according to his proud mother, often rattled along in beautiful German. Indeed, the younger Robeson prefers to express himself in German. But German fluency did not seem to bring a sanctuary for these beset travelers. Robeson and his companions were standing on the platform when the authorities accosted him in particular. 'This run-in,' he proclaimed, certainly would have meant my life if he had been unable to retain his composure. I remember getting ready for possible attack and determined to take some of the stormtroopers with me when cooler heads prevailed. It was a close call. It was a nightmare, according to Miss Robeson. Paul said he felt the atmosphere and the uniforms reminded him of a pack of wolves waiting and hoping to be unleashed and released. Like her husband, this journey was too spurring a heightening of her own political consciousness, which in turn complemented and strengthened that of her better-known husband. I suddenly understand for the first time, she confided in her diary, what the feeling must be of a black in Mississippi, i.e. fear, terror, horror, tension, nerve strain to the breaking point. Such relations were catalytic in driving the now politically engaged couple back across the Atlantic to their bedeviled homeland. I encountered trouble that might have well have meant my life, Robeson detailed later in speaking of a tense Berlin. Then it was on to the Soviet Union, and after that visit, he returned to London renewed. I saw the suffering about me with different eyes, he declared. I realized that the suffering of my own people was related to the sufferings of equally oppressed minorities. Later, I saw Austria in the dark days, Norway and Denmark on the edge of destruction. And these innervating experiences led to the political thrust that would define him to his dying days. Opposition to fascism at all costs and alignment with the force that seemed most disposed to confronting the same, communist parties. As his fluent Russian language skills suggested, Robeson's interest in the land of Lenin was not new. He had first become interested in visiting Russia during the late 1920s when conversations with friends while on vacation on the Riviera had provided him with an initial vicarious exposure to the Soviet Union. That his invitation was tendered by the internationally acclaimed filmmaker Sergei Eisenstein only increased his interest. Actually, said his friend and biographer Marie Seton, it was this acclaimed Soviet cineast who made a personal request for Robeson to appear in Moscow for intense discussions about a proposed movie about the Haitian Revolution. He had discussed this film with me, says Seton, shortly after returning from Mexico, and I transmitted an account of the project to Mr. Robeson. That his visit in Berlin was diametrically opposed from what he had encountered in Moscow, including a tense conversation with the former metropolis with a Jewish friend, only served to concretize his commitment to anti-fascism and solidarity with those of a similar outlook. From Moscow to Madrid. Robeson had arrived in Moscow in the mid-1930s at a front moment. I was there during the purges, he recounted later, and discussed his grave matter with Sergei Eisenstein, particularly the tragic fate that befell Soviet leader Nikolai Bukharin. This was an acknowledgement of the massive human rights violations then unfolding, but which communists and their sympathizers tended to rationalize as an unfortunate but necessary measure needed to brace effectively for the fascist onslaught, which was to cost tens of millions of lives in the Soviet Union. Some on the left alternately blamed these violations on provocations engineered by these very same fascists designed to ignite a bloody, massive overreaction in Moscow. Generally, Robeson leaned toward both viewpoints, and this opinion became part of the bill of indictment laid at his doorstep. He provided these critics with more ammunition when, on a subsequent visit to Moscow, he attended the Bolshoi Ballet with his son. Also, there was Stalin. Upon spotting him, the audience with Robeson included, began to applaud spontaneously. He was moved to speak of this leader's wonderful sense of kindliness. Here was one who was wise and good, he exulted. I lifted high my boy Paulie to wave to this world leader. Being able to speak Russian and practice this language on a mass basis for the first time seemed to strengthen Robeson's accelerating fondness for Moscow. His dedicated focus was noticed by his spouse. It would be thrilling to see how his Russian turns out, she said. He's so keen. He feels that he can become an official, an important interpreter of Russian music and literature. He feels he understands it and is close to it, and he loves the language. This love dovetailed with his simultaneously growing fascination with the socialist experiment, which mutually reinforced both. As Landa, in sum, was similarly impressed, and it appeared that her ability to evolve in his political direction, or perhaps adjust accordingly, strengthened what had been fraying a marital tie. Everywhere we had had marvelous audiences, she enthused. All were wildly appreciative. Their son, she said, was now in Russia Model School in Moscow, school number 25. Stalin's daughter and another top Soviet leader, Vyacheslav Molotov's son, are his schoolmates. Both she and her husband expressed astonishment at the complete lack of color consciousness they witnessed and encountered, which drove them to educate their son in the Soviet Union. Since both were born in a color-obsessed U.S., this perceived dearth of color consciousness was bound to have maximum impact on the two, seeming to be otherworldly in ratifying the idea that socialism meant a new deal for Africans and African Americans. It was this perception that had driven numerous Negroes, including Patterson and Robeson's other good friend, Ben Davis, into the ranks of the U.S. Communist Party. There was a New Year's reunion in Moscow in early January 1935 with members of her family. A high old time, had by all, she said with satisfaction. I am still full of vodka, caviar, champagne, and Russian cigarette smoke. The USSR is marvelous now, she rhapsodized, and thousands of well-stocked shops everywhere, and everyone well-fed and warmly dressed. Books everywhere, said the budding writer. Marvelous, cheap, everyone reads. They were residing at the National Hotel in Moscow, and it was from there that she informed Van Vechten that Paul's Russian is even more practical than he had hoped, and everyone is astounded and delighted when he speaks. So motivated, Miss Robeson intended, to learn Russian the moment I get home. We have spent days and nights with Sergei Einstein, who has shown us all his films. Also, Vsevolod Poduvkin and other Soviet artists were part of this grouping. We have been a great deal in the theater, but preferred the films here by far. A harbinger of Robeson's renewed interest in cinema upon his return. We both love it here and profoundly interested in what they are doing. Though it was 33 below zero and even the Russians hold their noses in the streets. They were hoping to leave for Leningrad soon, just in time for Marian Anderson's first concert there. She would be surprised, chuckled Atlanta. But she and Robeson were to be even more surprised when this noted contralto chose not to follow the politicized couple to the left, which had been the chosen path for so many Negro artists and intellectuals to that point. Miss Robeson was as ecstatic as her husband about this trip, which serves to drive them closer together. Sir J. Eisenstein introduced Paul to the packed audience, and they applauded for a full 2 minutes, creating a real storm. Paul spoke about how at home he felt there. They were astonished with his Russian, his accent, and adored him. He gave the whole short speech in Russian, she said. Apparently, as dumbstruck as those assembled, then he sang quite a lot of songs, which they loved, in Russian, of course. In terms of his artistry, in the long run, Robeson's renewed dedication to movie making may have been the most important aspect of this visit. Films are the medium of the future, said Islanta, more so in Russia than in any other place. To that end, we spent a lot of time with Sergei Eisenstein, who was now thinking over a project for Paul. The seriousness of this effort was signaled when the three talked for days and days on end about it. Filmmaking is notorious for giving rise to abortive projects, and this had occurred to Miss Robeson, who noted with astringency that what was being discussed may or may not pan out. But since Paul was on the front page every day, this suggested that this film project would become reality. Serendipitously, also in Moscow at that time was William I. Patterson, a fellow African-American attorney and friend of the couple who had joined the U.S. Communist Party a few years earlier. Patterson was essential to their radicalization process, as the couple saw him 3 times for long separate visits while we were in Russia. While all the government officials begged Robeson to go everywhere and see everybody, this meant Patterson was very pleased and flattered, not least since it assisted immeasurably his ongoing effort to recruit Robeson to the communist cause. Paul went over for a very long talk with Patterson, she said on 28 December 1934. And such long talks left an indelible impression upon the artist, who was becoming a revolutionary. In fact, those looking for a single day in which one can pinpoint when Robeson decisively turned to revolution, it would be this day in late December 1934. But the Moscow experiment too left an indelible impression. As Landa recalled it, her husband captivated Moscow. As they ambled along the often snowy streets, ordinary Moscovites approached them and urged the couple not to leave, but to make their home there. The fact that he spoke fluent Russian was essential to his popularity in the Soviet Union. This popularity led the couple to consider abandoning both Britain and the U.S. for permanent exile in the Soviet Union. He was an instant success, said a delighted Miss Robeson. He has conquered them with his Russian, his pure accent and fluency, and of course, they simply pass out when they hear him sing. A tendency, she thought, will sweep the country. It will settle us once and for all with the place, and we will always have entree here. Living is cheap, and I mean to always have a flat here. Islanda was not exaggerating, for Robeson's friend, Herbert Marshall, also encountered him in Moscow during his journey and left with a similar impression. The universality of socialism began to dovetail with Robeson's attempt to universalize his repertoire to the point that Marshall, who greeted Paul and his wife, Essie, as they first set foot in Moscow, found that his songs in concert became more international than any other singers in history. Then he sought to extend this trend to the stage, as he wanted to play Othello in Russian with a Russian company and to sing Boris Godunov. With his Russian language aptitude burnished, Robeson and his accompanists departed Moscow on 6 January 1935 after intensive conferences with Einstein and Patterson. It was then that Patterson pressed him to return to the U.S. to join the struggle against Jim Crow, a request that led to an initial demurral, but an ultimate acceptance. But at that juncture, Robeson was unconvinced. "I found in London," he said later, "a congenial and stimulating intellectual atmosphere in which I felt at home, to the point where I thought that I was settled for life." Upon returning to London, he was to be found more frequently at sites such as the Royal Institute of International Affairs and Chatham House, speaking about the problems of Africa alongside the Prince of Wales, the foremost Tory politician, Stanley Baldwin, and other leaders from Australia, Canada, South Africa, and New Zealand. In early 1935, he was visiting Ireland for a second time and drawing parallels between the music there and that of his homeland, and reflecting upon the history and reality of the land that had been denoted as London's first colony. Such comparisons were nothing new for Robeson, who now seemed to be more enmeshed in studying than performing. The Negro spiritual and Hebrew chant have the same plaintive note, was the message delivered to a Jewish publication. "Both of our peoples have known oppression, and I feel at home singing in Hebrew," a language he had heard at the knee of his late father. "Perhaps," he continued, "that while I feel so close to the Jews, that and the fact that in London and New York, both my friends were Russian Jews." From Dundee, Scotland, he waxed at length about his affinity with the Hebrides. "I am convinced," said his bona fide linguist, "I shall be able to learn Gaelic much more easily than French or German. I learned to speak Russian in 6 months and thought this feat could be duplicated in learning Gaelic." Slowly but surely, Robeson was developing a theory of music that would then merge with his theory of politics. That is, music showed that humanity was one, and the diverse struggles of humanity likewise demonstrated that the socialist commonwealth was the one common goal to which all were advancing, and indeed that this was the universal resolution of these struggles. Countries as far apart as Scotland and China had music that used the universal pentatonic scale, he said, and it could also be found in the music of African Americans, in the songs of India, and the ancient Hebraic chants. The Moscow visit had not crushed his intense interest in languages, but instead had accelerated this trend, for his growing fascination with the philosophical universalism of socialism underscored his strengthening belief of the unity of all humankind. As Lander thought in due time that Robeson would take a PhD in philology, He adores languages and is now doing comparative work in African languages. His study of languages often took place in the comfortable Robeson flat on Buckingham Street near the Strand, close to the Times. Convenient transportation nodes, theaters, and so on. Nonetheless, despite their increasing global profile, the couple seemed to face a perpetual household deficit. Days after returning from Moscow, Ms. Robeson was groaning about how it would be hard going for the next few months, as I have all these bills to settle, rattling off her rolls and larger in Jaeger, two stores popular with fashion devotees, being in the public eye, in the crosshairs of gossip columnists, and being part of an industry that placed a premium on glamour. The Robesons had to be fashionably attired, which came at a steep cost. But as their politics evolved, a process compelled by the rise of fascism and its antipode, anti-fascism, the Robesons' view of consumption evolved accordingly. The conversations with Patterson taking place in a Moscow convulsed with change left a deep imprint upon Robeson particularly. Robeson began to rail against crass materialism upon his return from Moscow, the sort that places the acquisition of property above all else, that makes possession of material comforts an end in itself. Hence, despite these financial pressures, upon his return to London, a renewed Robeson turned his attention to what may have been the least lucrative of his artistic pursuits, the stage. By April, he was starring in a play about an African chief trying valiantly to keep rapacious Europeans away from the gold embedded in his nation. Peter Garland penned a part specifically for him with an African-related theme. By May 1935, he was receiving rave reviews for his performance as a stevedore, an emblem of his developing socialist ideology, which saw such proletarians as being in the vanguard of a revolutionary upsurge. The theme of this work was that the persistence of racism was due not least to its deliberate incitement by bosses in order to make for a more pliable Negro workforce. As millions marched globally for the Scottsboro defendants, this play provided a withering indictment of Jim Crow. His friend and biographer, Marie Seton, was effusive, proclaiming that with this production, for the first time in the theater, Negroes were shown fighting for their rights and lives, with white workers joining them in their resistance to a racist mob. A few years later, he took this portrayal of working class militancy on the stage to a new level with this role in Plant in the Sun, which centered on a sit-down strike in the U.S. candy factory. This play made a strongly dramatic appeal, a call to arms, to organize unions, a signature theme for Robeson in the coming years. The moral for workers was simple: stick together or the boss will beat you all down. Reflecting his growing egalitarianism, instead of accompanying the star's dressing room at the Theatre Royal, Drury Lane, he shared one room with the whole company, possibly the atmosphere of ease thereby created among the cast contributed to the play becoming a sensation. Join the likes of Jawar Jawaharlal Nehru and Krishna Menon, creating a lifelong bond with Indian stalwarts. Refusing to exercise class privilege, Robeson even insisted on sweeping the theater. It was then that Robeson began to donate heavily to the cause of Indian independence. This was significant, for although he received £500 per concert, he appeared in Plant in the Sun for almost nothing. His depiction of Toussaint L'Ouverture, hero of the Haitian Revolution, in the eponymous play written by the Trinidadian intellectual C.L.R. James, prompted the New Statesman to term him one of the most impressive actors alive. Robeson said, "The New York Times, with enthusiasm, naturally outshone the large cast. It was staged at the 730-seat Westminster Theatre on the fringes of London's West End, and its modest circumstances notwithstanding, received a thunderous reception. Robeson was singled out with a stormy ovation at the final curtain, with one contemporary critic claiming that the play most surely stand as the most outstanding anti-imperialist play ever to make it into London's West End during the interwar period. Though he was offered fabulous salaries to star elsewhere, he preferred less remunerative but more meaningful roles. Yet, as his huddling with Einstein in Moscow suggested, Robeson had hardly turned his back on movies. But unlike the stage, here his best efforts were subject to the deviousness of film editing and the misdirection or simple expediency of shooting films out of sequence. This was the backdrop to the production of perhaps his most controversial and damaging artistic creation, his role in Sanders of the River, a drama about Africa that somehow he thought would be anti-colonial. This production was racked with difficulty from day one. I do not yet quite understand how the picture came to finality," said Alex Wall, the interior designer, later, what with money troubles for the producers and the difficulty of shooting Africa in England. In this movie, Robeson betrays a literate and well-educated African leader who is in alliance with British colonialism. The pro-colonial theme of this movie was evident, and the depiction of Africans was similarly objectionable. Certainly, all viewers were not displeased with this production. One correspondent in Los Angeles breathlessly told the Robesons that audiences ate it up, for not once but at least five times in the eight showings of Sanders, I witnessed the audience burst into applause. In Jerusalem, where Robeson was told the building up of a Jewish national home seems to be going forward in a very lively pace, Mayor Richard Harris was equally elated. He saw it in Tel Aviv, the 100% Jewish city, and it made an outstanding success, being held over for an entire week. The Hebrew papers had the highest praise for the picture. And I personally, he stressed, thought you were excellent. As late as 1960, Kathleen Ross felt compelled to inform Robeson that, like many other white children, I was always threatened with, if you don't be good, the black man would take you away. and I was really scared. And then she saw Sanders and started reading everything I could about Africa. And I thought how stupid I had been to be scared. There was a similarly enthusiastic response to his star turn in the film version of Showboat, with one Hollywood executive claiming that it was a sensational success. You knocked them cold, James Will of Universal Pictures claimed rarely at any preview or showing of any picture. Had he witnessed such overwhelming enthusiasm after the singing of Old Man River, he bellowed, the house went just crazy. The spine-chilling effect of that one song I should never forget. Such adulation paved the way for Robeson's journey to Egypt, where he starred in Jericho. The British ambassador came along, he told the BBC later, doubtlessly attracted by the opportunity to rub shoulders with stardom. They were in North Africa for 2 months, said Miss Robeson. It was most interesting, though certainly strenuous. The former reference may have been a veiled allusion to allegations spread by the U.S. authorities that it was in North Africa that Robeson and Lady Mountbatten were enmeshed in a love affair. Unfortunately, fervent endorsement of Robeson's cinematic handiwork was not the opinion of his comrades or progressives generally. All told, Robeson acted in about a dozen films and other than Proud Valley, which was filmed in Wales among coal miners. He was generally dissatisfied with his cinematic efforts. This dissatisfaction led him to abandon movies as early as the 1940s, though his concert and theater performances continued unabated. The years in which Robeson appeared on screen, roughly from the 1920s to the early 1940s, also marked a period when all but the most comic and jesting Negro figures were driven from Hollywood. This formidable barrier helped to drive him to London. But as Sanders of the River suggested, this European capital of cinema proved to be hardly different. One critic concluded that British film differs from American pictures in that it depicts the Negro in a heroic light. But Robeson's career did not altogether confirm this thesis. Perhaps even overly generous, Robeson argued that it was sly editing that sabotaged this film from his viewpoint. Evidently, Robeson was unduly impressed with the African dancing on which the producers expended thousands of feet of celluloid and which too moved many audiences. A chastened Robeson admitted that the film resolved itself into a piece of flag waving in which I wasn't interested, amounting to a total loss. But I didn't realize how seriously people might take the film until I went back to New York and was confronted by angry critics such as his friend and comrade Ben Davis. There I was met by a deputation who wanted to know how the hell I had come to play in a film which stood for everything they rightly thought I opposed. That deputation, he noted tellingly, began to make me see things more clearly. A gross understatement in that this experience both drove him away from filmdom and toward deeper political engagement. At the film's premiere, Robeson seethed. By one account, he stormed out. Another report asserted that he refused to rise and either speak or sing for the audience. Instead, he departed angrily with his fury, matching his vehemence of his sturdiest critics. His ire was not assuaged by the fact that the premier in London raised a hefty 20,000 pounds, a record for all time for the newspaper press fund, he was told. Nor was the pain eased by a London film executive informing his spouse that her husband's perfect figure, probably the finest of all contemporary males, was shown to good effect on the screen, i.e., that its being particularly nude is not nearly so noticeable as it would be if he had a bad figure. He was largely confronted by the allegation that the picture, as you know, is a tremendous success. When Sanders of the Rise premiered, the London Press reported that in Leicester Square, there were police cordons and appearances by the Queen of Spain, the U.S. ambassador, and assorted courageous, while Robeson himself was mobbed by excited women. This was followed by Robeson in concert, according to other bewitched reporter, holding 6,000 spellbound at the Royal Albert Hall. Robeson's good friend Ben Davis, like Patterson, an African-American attorney who turned his back on potential wealth for the uncertainty of becoming a professional revolutionary, a full-time communist, denounced Sanders of the River as a slanderous attack on Africans, a declaration with which Robeson asserted his agreement. Another friend, the heiress Nancy Conard, was irate, calling the movie nothing else than one more intense effort at a justification of imperialistic exploitation. The Journal of Marcus Garvey, though admitting that Robeson was a Negro of genius, reprimanded him for the movie roles he felt compelled to perform. Nigerians studying at Cambridge University were irate. In this, they were simply following the lead of anti-colonial leader and Robeson friend Nnamdi Azikiwe. In Palestine, one Robeson correspondent thought the story was weak and propaganda for British imperialism. You really deserve more worthy vehicles in which to express yourself, a thought that had occurred to Robeson too. How are you getting on with your Hebrew? He asked, as if a vehicle in that language might be next and more suitable. It was not easy to reject filmdom, since the pay was quite gainful, and unlike concerts or plays, allowed him to extend his influence into the four corners of the globe. As early as 1932, Universal Pictures in Hollywood offered him $100,000 to appear in four films, all to be completed within a year. With the appeal delivered by film, Maxwell House Coffee then offered him $60,000 for a year's contract. 30 minutes of his time once a week for a year would be his commitment. Writing to the Robesons in 1938 at their residence in Highgate Road in London, the family having moved, John Corfield of British National Films was considering a cash payment of £5,000 for one film appearance plus a percentage, a generous one, he added enticingly. Though perhaps seen as generous in retrospect, Cornfield was apologetic, scraping and bowing because he was not able to offer more. The present state of the industry, he observed, with steadily failing receipts and with majority of film production companies in this country either idle through lack of funds or actually in the hands of a receiver, made it difficult to offer more. Robeson had options beyond London and Hollywood, for it was then that Sergei Einstein in the Soviet Union, wrote Dear Essie and Paul with evident excitement. I am extremely pleased, he said, to inform you that all my troubles are over. A vague reference to the political instability in Moscow that had led to purges and executions. New people are running the film business. Everything has changed, and I'm working full speed on one of the most important pictures to be made this year. He was referring to Alexander Nevsky, a cinematic landmark, which said the filmmaker deals with great victory we Russians had in the 13th century over the German invasion. An obvious harbinger of what was to come. How modern the thing is, he added, and how close to everything happening in Spain and Austria, noting the final defeat of the Germans in 1242, I hope to become prophetic, which was bloody percent. Robeson's friendship with Einstein and Moscow proved to be beneficial. It was in 1937 that an executive from Universal Pictures contacted Robeson from Moscow, reporting that he was finding a favorable reception as he screened the print of Our Showboat, which the Soviet authorities have just been looking at with the view of purchasing Sane for this country, since the main interest centers around you and your popularity in Russia. Robeson was noticeably interested in working with Einstein, though, alas, they were unable to collaborate. It was in 1938 that he informed a curious interviewer that Hirto, the dramaticist he had been working with, mostly British and Euro-American, usually go wrong when they try to write a part for a Negro character. Not unnaturally, they tend to see him as a specialized person. This distorts the importance given to the character and makes him unrepresentative. He distinguished the character he played in Plant in the Sun, which was written by the author, as an Irishman, an indicator that he argued writers should write about a character they know in their own experience. Then let me play the part and give it a special, not unrepresentative Negro flavor. In any case, even this admonition did not necessarily boost his fondness for filmmaking, since that industry represented the clearest example of the workings of capitalism. Slumps, bums, booms, speculation, overproduction, etc. Of Robeson's three artistic outlets, concert, theater, and cinema, the latter two, particularly movie making, involved significant capital outlays by investors, most of whom were not politically progressive, which led inexorably to often damaging compromises on Robeson's part. Capital investors were not necessarily interested in anti-capitalist and anti-imperialistic productions. Concert singing, on the other hand, with the lucrative complement of recordings providing global reach, was not so compromising, and inevitably, this is where Robeson turned as his revolution leanings deepened, for this outlet allowed not only for the expression of anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist sentiments, but anti-racist sentiments as well. Yet signaling the restiveness that was soon to make Hollywood a byword for radicalism, necessitating, in the eyes of conservatives, a decisive and transformative purge and shakeup that would ensnare Robeson. He stressed that in the movie industry as he told the interviewer Sidney Cole. The workers in the studios have the power that they ought to realize, and they ought to realize it. During one of my films, I was struck by this very forcibly. There was everybody on the set, lights burning, director waiting, head of the company had just come on to the set with some big financial backer to see how things were going. And what happened? Everything stopped. Why? Because the electricians had decided it was time to go and eat as they just put out the lights and went off and ate. That's my moral to your readers. The moral to Robeson was that he had landed in a market, movie making, which turned out to be a major export earner for the U.S. and besides massaged consciousness globally at the same time. He then donated his income and time to building working class and revolutionary movements that placed the power and wealth of movie mongols in the bullseye. Their response, in turn, was to isolate Robeson politically, denude him of wealth, and make him radioactive politically. This, despite this leverage, he had to give up film acting because of the problems of finding adequate scripts. This he regretted, since he thought that film was his true medium, i.e., the intimacy of working close to the camera. Close-up shots, in short, he could express his personality more sympathetically and with less strain, especially compared to the projection and, at times, histrionics required for concerts and the stage. Though it was not detailed by Einstein in their correspondence, Robeson was eager to bring to the screen a reworked reprise of the London stage drama featuring the Haitian Revolution. When he traveled to Moscow in late 1934, a central purpose was to confer with Einstein about a Haitian project. His trip, said Maurice Seton, was at the personal request of the great Soviet movie maker, and intense discussions ensued immediately after he landed at the airport. I transmitted an account of the project to Miss Robeson, says Seton. But as so often happens with capital intensive film projects, this one was too stillborn. The skilled U.S. writer Waldo Frank thanked Miss Robeson for providing a copy of the book on the topic by C.L.R. James, The Black Jacobins, which inspired him to draft very roughly the idea I had for a truly great work about Toussaint. He intended it for Paul, though it depends on him. Frank was also communicating with two lovely young Negro writers, one of whom was Richard Wright, who emerged from the same political milieu as Robeson and who went on to write a novel, Native Son, making him as prominent in literature as Robeson was on the stage. But what might have captured Atlanta's eye was his concluding dig. You two don't know what you're missing spending your life in a stagnant eddy swiftly turning into a sewer like England. Let Paul read this, please, he insisted. But Paul did not have to read this jab from Frank in order to realize that there were stirrings back home, driven by anti-fascist ripples from abroad. The impending alliance with Moscow and the committed surge of the anti-Jim Crow movement that was to impel the Robesons to cross the Atlantic, but this time for a longer, more permanent period. Robeson's frustration with movies helped to fuel his revolutionary fervor as he came to recognize that the status quo could not contain his more capacious ambitions. I want to make a film about Samuel Coleridge Taylor, he said in the 1930s, referring to the turn of the century British composer, routinely referred to as the African Mailer, and Joe Louis too, the heavyweight boxing champion, otherwise known as the Bomber, a contemporary of Robeson. But the Hollywood companies would not let me do the latter, nor was the former actionable either. They say it would never do for a colored man to be shown knocking out a white boxer. These reluctant executives may have noticed interviews he was now giving to the U.S. Communist Party daily newspaper. In one, he was open about his affection for the Soviet Union. "I tend to live there," he declared. "It's the only country in the world where I feel at home." When asked the question that would bedevil him for years to come, he said that he wasn't a member of the Communist Party. "I'm a member of the Friends of the Soviet Union," he confessed.
Context of white supremacy. End of our first audio segment, courtesy of retired firefighter. In my book, this is the middle of 72. I'm not sure it might, you know, depend on which version of the text you have. But for me, middle of 72 is where we will pick up at for the second audio segment. Paragraph, two paragraphs after the mention of Joe Louis. Dr. Gerald Horn's biography on Paul Robeson, the artist as revolutionary, getting into some of the changings in his political understanding. Some important changes this week reminded me of Malcolm X's autobiography to some degree. I have to pause and give one more anecdote. It's a rough Thursday on the plantation. After years, and I mean years of saying almost with a badge of honor, Gus T., not having a cell phone. I think we did the first 217 programs with no personal computer, no cell phone, made a compensatory investment request to a white person, purchased me a phone and paid the bill for 2 years. And then after that, I did not have a phone. I broke down and got a phone today. It was not a celebration at all, not even close. In fact, to emphasize, no celebration around it at all. And in fact, to emphasize, the phone is not even in the room with me presently. I made sure to put it like outside so that I could have some distance from it. I was even more repulsed. It's one of those phones, you know, you have the key to lock the phone, you have some sort of code to lock it. This is one of those newfangled gadgets where it can do the thumbprint to unlock. I was horrified. That's why it's outside right now. use when needed and then throw it back out. And then I was even more horrified after I actually got the phone and I turned to look as I was out shopping to get my phone and other sundries. And everybody was on their phones. Oh, God, I have not been one of those because I don't have a phone, so that's not me. I'm not even a 21st century citizen, anachronistic in some sense, out of time and place. I said, I do not want that to change now that I have a phone outside the room. I almost was reminded of our narrator, retired firefighter. In fact, I was so repulsed about the idea, I almost said, "I wonder if I can find me one of those flip phone Jimmies. That's about all I need. I can get one of those flip phones and be more anachronistic. I don't even know if they make those anymore." Remember those, the flip phones? That was like 15 years ago, I think. Anyway, Paul Robeson, back to the book club. If you have comments to share, 605-313-5164, decode 564-943 pound. press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If we had folks who were timely and you got to hear the opening interview that Mr. Robeson did on KPFA, if you have any thoughts, please share again. I guess this was later because that interview was from 1958, so that was substantially down the road. That's like 20 years later, so you can see the growth from that interview to what we're hearing about this week, which is in like the 1930s. So you can see 20 years of him thinking about this problem and how he was talking to the whites at KPFA. Brilliant segment. All right, folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have thoughts on the segment of the reading or the interview, star 61, folks with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Nope, we have our narrator, retired firefighter. Are you using your flip phone?
I use that object to the extent where it just fell apart in my hands one day. I mean, I got everything out of a flip phone, and that was my only reason why I graduated to the more modern day version of phones, simply because there wasn't any more flip phones that I could buy. So I had to buy, I don't even know what this phone is called that I have, but it's not the most updated ones, but that's what I graduated to. And it was only because I could not buy another flip phone. Yes, technology is not always to the advantage. I was just thinking about, through this particular report, what was being identified was, I would say, that the cinema filming basically was the technology. I could be wrong about this, but it's just a thought. Was the technology that really compromised people's interest into reading. I would say even non-white black people definitely had a higher level for interest in reading before movies and cinema existed. They had a higher one definitely than they have today of reading. And I think what took place was cinema and quote unquote television is what compromised people's interests to read. Even those who could not read, but they were interested in being taught to read. And I think television kind of took that away, and it persuaded people into thinking that it's outdated to read. But really what actually took place was, with the advent of cinema and television, you can go behind a door and edit and doctor up something to whereas it can be whoever the person that's behind that door or whoever controls that person behind that door says it's true or says it's untrue. And normally that's a powerful white person. Which is in some cases the same with books, but books has a lot more chance for accuracy, I would say, out of the two. So that's kind of like a real long report. As far as, but we started with my phone, but That's what I moved into. But if I can, to go on with my understandings of the first reading, the first thing that I noted here was, once again, Mr. Robeson's expertise, I would say, with his ability to, in such a short period of time, I don't speak another language but English, but so I'm not, you know, really good at measuring it. But I would assume that someone that can understand another language in months, and we're talking about back in the early part of the 20th century, have to have some kind of natural abilities or talent, and in turn have worked themselves into being very patient, with those skills that he was able to put together. He started figuring out through music that there was some sort of connecting source, I guess, in the words. And with that, he decided to use that understanding to be able to persuade people towards correctness and oppose incorrectness, I would say. Also, on page 58, it basically tells me of how he was developing a more understanding of racism, white supremacy as being a global problem with his travels. And he was seeing some similarities of instances almost wherever he went, other than his quote-unquote homeland. Going into chapter 4, what do I have here? I already mentioned about the ability to read was usurped by television, and even so with film. But he was quite disappointed with film, primarily because of what he was talking about on how they would clip up. This one film that he had, where he clipped it up and tied it up to someone else's likeness. And he became very discouraged about that in this first reading. From the standpoint of, he thought that what was his best means to influence people was his ability to sing, and sing in the language of the people that he wants to affect, and also his acting on stage. And I would say personally, I myself always admired the people who ended up becoming stars, quote unquote stars, in cinema. Some of the best ones were before they were being filmed, they did stage appearances. One in particular was Sidney Poitier, had a similar background. Even in a lesser mode, the person who played, I can't remember his name, his real name, but he played the Sarge in this movie that was back in the 1990s about, what was the name of that movie? I just can't think of the name of that movie. But the guy who played Sarge in this particular movie, he also played in another movie that had Oprah Winfrey in it. He was a stage performer. The reason why I like them, because they have to, in order to impress the audience, they also have to be very good at their facial and body movements while you're on stage to convince people on what you're saying or what you're doing. And that becomes something that I pay attention to when I'm watching film. And Paul Robeson certainly was an early expert at those things. And I can go on, but that's basically what I have for right now. Thank you.
Much obliged for the narration and the observations, retired firefighter. Mr. Demery Ford with us as well. If you have thoughts, questions, proceed.
Oh, yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. You know, I think last week I got a little ahead of myself because in this week's reading, it's when I guess he ended up in Germany around 1934, and he's running into, he called them stormtroopers, which they were probably Nazi SS troopers, and they were coming straight for him, and he said he remembered getting ready for a possible attack and determined to take some of the stormtroopers with him when cooler heads prevail. And I guess his wife recalled that, you know, she was frightened also. But I can imagine the terror and the fear, you know, during that time. And he being a celebrity, and then those SS Nazi troops, you know, could care less about his celebrity status. They would have just treated him just like the book says, just like they did other non-white minorities and other blacks and Jews in at that particular time. And the book started talking about purges. So Mr. Robeson was aware of a lot of atrocities that was going on at the time, but I thought it was, pretty ingenious of Stalin to confuse a man like Mr. Robeson into thinking that he had a wonderful sense of kindness. I mean, I think Stalin was probably had more people murdered than, I think it was a race between him and Mussolini. But, you know, it's easy to say in an afterthought, but during the time when these things are happening, whites are very clever at disguising their intentions and you're not really, they hide in plain sight. also, their son was going to school with Stalin's daughter, more confusion, I think. And they was just astonished with the lack of color consciousness. That's, a form of white validation. And then desiring to stay in Moscow and in Russia at 33 below zero. I mean, I've been in Germany when it was 7 below, and that was cold enough for me. I couldn't see that. William Patterson, I'm wondering about this guy because it says that you know, it looks like he's recruiting him into the Communist Party, which we know that, you know, whether he's actually recruiting him into the Communist Party, because they probably don't even enter like that. That looks like a setup to me, something that may have been done from this side, from the Americans rather than the rest. But I think that Robeson was sincere in his humanity and starting to believe that music, you know, was universal and that somehow we could all live together. But the way the system is designed, and those that classify themselves as white, as long as they're in charge, they're not having any of that. He started to have a conflict also. He was having some lucrative pursuits. But then some of the plays and parts that they wanted him to do, movie parts, were, as the book said, they were, you know, they were beneath him. They were just roles that was typical for that time for blacks. One particular play, Plant in the Sun, was centered on a sit-down strike of a U.S. candy factory. That kind of reminds us of the last novel with old Valerian and his family becoming rich from the candy business. And I thought it was also interesting that Kathleen Ross, on page 66, felt compelled to tell Robeson about how she, like so many white children, was always threatened with, if you don't be good, the black man will take you away. And she said she was really scared, but when she started reading about Africa, and she thought about how stupid it had been to be scared. Another instance of white people cannot be ignorant about racism, because in that little short section, it looks as though the parents were using black people to scare the kids from an early age, and then she pretending like she didn't know any difference, even mad as she was grown, that black people may come and get her. But anyway, mention of a brown bomber and you know, I was also interested in Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois' wife, Shirley Graham. You know, she, I don't think the book elaborated on her very much, but she was an award-winning author, and she was a playwright, and she was also a distinguished person, so I think that's noteworthy. I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged to Mr. Demery for...
If anyone is ignorant about racism, it's black people.
Absolutely, we do not have white people who are ignorant about racism. Not in the 1930s. Not in 2030. Hopefully we'll have solved this problem by then. If other folks, star 6-1, if you have a thought or comment. Great connection, Valerian Street, white people rich from all that sugar, got black people out there in the cane fields. I did want to get in quickly as well about books being more accurate. I think that has come up before in some discussions. In fact, I think that is in amusing ourselves to death, which is right along the lines of what retired firefighters said. That book is written by Neil Postman. We read one of his other books, Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk, which is really good too about language, but he's written a lot of books. Amusing ourselves to death is along that same premise about people not reading anymore and what are the consequences of people not reading. And I've heard other people say that it's more difficult or books are more likely to be truthful. Now, we did read Lothrop Stoddard's The Rising Tide of White World Supremacy on the book club. So, and we read William Pierce. They mention it every time somebody blows up a building. The Turner Diaries, that's it. William Pierce, The Turner Diaries, that's in the book club too. So certainly David Duke, I think, has written a book, Klan Member, Race Soldier. So certainly it's not too difficult to write a book with inaccurate information, deliberately or accidentally. I mean, hey, we're in a system of racism, white supremacy, where sometimes it can be difficult to get accurate information to even record. So books can be problematic as well. Just, I guess, a word of caution about privileging books as being more accurate or more honest. Although, in Amusing Ourselves to Death, he does say that books, just because language demands a certain logic, you can't just say anything, whereas with television, you can kind of flash anything up on the screen and get away with a lot more than with writing. You can't do that. There has to be a little bit more logic in writing. So that is important to what retired firefighter said. To specific notes from the text, when they got into the details about them hanging out in Moscow, lots of vodka, sobriety would be best. He said vodka and champagne and cigarette smoke, like triple whammy. All that aside, traveling is really important. It seems like him traveling, I think we'll hear more about him traveling in the second audio segment, at least in my view, being curious about the planet on which we reside, I think is huge. And I think as long as we're under a system of white supremacy racism, generally, I think as you travel, that will just be confirmed. I think for some people, if you don't understand racism, white supremacy, maybe it can cause greater confusion. But I think for a lot of folks, you get to trap. Mr. Fuller, he was in the services. He traveled, said he started thinking about codification while he was in Japan. Being able to travel and get like a global perspective, like, oh, this is not just an Alabama thing. Why is it the same everywhere? Why is it like this in Nigeria? Why is it like this all over? Like, what? Oh, I get it. You start to understand. Next, Othello comes up again. We had all that, you know, talk last week, and Othello, black male in this play drawn crazy by a white woman. He already had that other All Gods Chillin' Got Wings, where he's in this toxic relationship with a white woman. That's going to be your claim to fame, to get to play to a sold out audience of whites, drunk whites probably, as you perform being in some sort of tacky arrangement, sexual arrangement with a white woman. And to some degree, that is still the case today, 2020, basically. Let's see. I thought the white identification with so-called Jews, I'm saying the Negro spiritual and the Hebrew chant have the same plaintive note. The message was delivered to a Jewish publication. Both of our people have known oppression, and I feel at home singing in Hebrew. Now, this is even before the whole Nazi terrorist explosion in the later 1930s and 1940s. But I hear this talked about a lot. Mr. Fuller has just fantastic anecdote about this, people connecting those two. No idea what you're talking about. There are black people who are so-called Jewish or Jews. So what are we talking about? What are we thinking? That means you got Negro Jews. What are we talking about? Sammy Davis Jr. is one, I thought. There are others. Let's see. Alice Walker, I think, is when Color Purple was on my mind for a reason. I think Alice Walker and or her daughter may also be so-called Jews or Jewish. Let's see. I talked about last week the show-offism. It seemed like there was quite a bit of that in terms of people that we know that we get the pleasure or the privilege of hanging out with, many of them white, and sometimes it'll be a really well-to-do black person as well, or showing off places that we've been and what we had and things that we bought. On 64, days after returning from Moscow, Ms. Robeson was groaning about how it would be hard for the next few months as I have all these bills to settle, rattling off Harrods and Jaeger, two stores popular with fashion devotees, being in the public eye in the crosshairs of gossip columnists and being part of an industry that placed a premium on glamour, the Robesons had to be fashionably attired, which came at a steep cost. All of that showing off and paying white people. Talked about last week, Mr. Robeson was talking about how the taxes, how much he had to pay. 1920, 2020, same thing. Let's see it. I appreciate the very next paragraph. The Robeson's view of consumption evolved accordingly. The conversations with Patterson taking place in a Moscow convulsed with change left a deep imprint upon Robeson particularly. Robeson began to rail against crass materialism upon his return from Moscow, the sort that places the acquisition of property above all else. I remember we had Dr. Trav on the program, and he said valuing time and energy more than money and things. Reminded me a lot of counter-racist thinking and how we can go about solving this problem and not being so attached to physical possessions. Let's see. And again, just seeing how his views evolve. But when they mention the so-called socialist movement and the white people that were involved with the Scottsboro case, and there were also Rosa Parks. The general Rosa Parks was active at this time. She was a contemporary. She was working right there for the Scottsboro Boys and other black people throughout the South, even at this time. But that confusion we've talked about, where you have sometimes whites will come out and pretend that they're against racism. You have some of this in the 1960s with so-called Woodstock and the same thing. Sometimes they use society for SDS, Society for Students for Democratic Society. That's it. Some of the same thing. The weathermen, they say, oh, down with capitalism, down with the system. We're not going to be yet. Some of the same thing in the 1960s. Arguably, you have some of the same thing right now, 2020. The whites say, oh, I'm not racist. This Donald Trump has got to go. He's out of here. I'm not with him, down and with the whole GOP party and all of you get this. It pops up regularly. Like you had some of that with the Wall Street and the 1% when they were doing Occupy Wall Street. That was about 10 years ago or so. You will have that pop up from time to time, and I think that can cause a lot of confusion for non-white people worldwide, and it seemed like that did impact Mr. Robeson. He was talking about in this play some idea of black people joining together with white people to work against a racist mob. That is super, super duper fantasy. There have been brief and super brief illustrations of that, but the overwhelming trend on the planet is the white mob comes in and beats down the black people. Maybe you have one white person, oh my gosh, don't do that to them, but they're overwhelmed and not of any help. Certainly you're not going to have armed whites saying, oh yeah, I'm going to protect Nigger Jim, and I got my musket right here to do so. That has been few and far between. 2020, 1920. CLR James, that's the cowbell. He was mentioned a few times. Sorry, been mentioned in the book, but that's another cowbell. When he talked about the different ways that he was duped and he would do these films and they would end up editing the project or presenting it in such a way, Sanders, where it would end up showing, let's see, he had, this is on page 66, he says, talking about Sanders, this production was racked with difficulty from day one. They were what with money troubles for the producers and the difficulty of shooting Africa in England. In this movie, Robeson portrays a literate and well-educated African leader who is in alliance with British colonialism, white supremacists. The pro-colonial theme of this movie was evident, and the depiction of Africans was similarly objectionable, racist. Certainly all viewers were not displeased with this production. And he talks about how we went to these crowds of whites in Jerusalem who are supposedly, they're supposed to have a lot of ties with black people, unless I misinterpreted what was written. And they applauded and were just elated. And he talks about going to other events where it seemed like there were a lot of white people and they thought it was great. And I think that that can happen regularly, where because we don't understand white supremacy, racism, we get confused about what it is, how it works, and even projects that we get involved in. We get involved thinking one thing. Sometimes they can change it up. Sometimes they can edit it, or sometimes we just don't understand. And it might not even grasp until we see the final project, and then, and might even have to have somebody point out to us then. Let's see. I appreciate when he begins to go into how Marcus Garvey and some of his contemporaries, Marcus Garvey, Ben Davis, friends, he said, not just contemporaries, how when they informed him, you know, hey, Paul, these movies are beneath you. I'm just echoing what Mr. Demery Ford said. You can do better. They're racist. And look at how they're portraying you. Look at how they're portraying us. Black people collectively, and him saying, wow, him not being defensive, because that can happen to the best. I mean, you're talking about, this is not like a private whoops. This is a public out on stage in front of millions of people and all of that. And, oh, man, did I mess up? Did they get me? And I so appreciate him being humble. This is someone who studied so much in law school or studied law at Columbia, has studied all these languages, did all this traveling, made all this money from theater and film, and to be humble enough to say, wow, I did not understand. I need to step back and reevaluate. And thank you for letting me know. Thank you all for having the insight to let me know that I'm messing up, that I need to do better. I need to be more careful about which roles that I take. I think that's super constructive, because I know so frequently that is not the case. We are not receptive to feedback, talking about myself and victims of white supremacy in general, but that often that is the case, unfortunately, and that's why I recommend you wait. Apparently, Mr. Robeson, it seems like he might have been that type of fellow that said, hey, Gus T., if you got feedback, let me know. I will think about it, and maybe I need to reevaluate it. If that's the case, man, that's something we can definitely emulate, that humility. Let's see. Oh, and I appreciate also them including, you know, he was making a lot of money doing these films that are promoting white supremacy, racism, colonialism, as it's called, where they said as early as 1932, Universal Pictures, they're still in business, going strong, in Hollywood, offered him $100,000 to appear in four films, all to be completed within a year. Now, I mean, this is 1932. $25,000 per picture. I'd have to get my inflation calculated to see what that is, but I bet that's over $1 million. Like, wow, a substantial amount of money. And to be, and then, and to have that too, you could get a lot of money. I was, black self-respect has been on my mind for days. Ivy mentioned it yesterday. We could put $1 million in your hand. Now, you're going to be up here. You'll even be an intelligent black person, but you'll be partnered up with some white people. We'll show some dancing niggers with spears. It'll be great. You'll love it. $1 million. They do the same thing right now, 2020. Lots of illustrations. Won't call any names. I will pause, though, because they mentioned Richard Wright, Native in the Sun. That's a cowbell for a lot of reasons. And I had mentioned, I think, that book when I gave my reservations about having to read another book where it was going to be a black male who rapes a white woman or does something sexual to a white woman. That was one of the books I mentioned, Native Son, where the main black character, Bigger Thomas, he doesn't kill or he doesn't rape the white woman, but the sexual aggression is there. He does kill her and burns up the body, and then he ends up being killed and whatever, whatever. But the wacky thing about it is that I was going to check retired firefighter. He was trying to think of the black male actor who played the sergeant. He said she was in a picture with Oprah Winfrey. So I was trying to see if I could find it. While I was looking, Oprah Winfrey was in Native Son. It was written by Richard Wright at about the exact time period we're talking about in this book, in the 1930s. And they have a picture. You can look. And I think we had to watch that movie when we read the book in school. If you look, they have a picture of her looking bedraggled and exactly, and I mean exactly the way she looks in the film The Color Purple, if you've seen it. And she's got her son, Bigger Thomas, after he's been captured, and he's on death row for killing the white woman, and he's in shackles and got his bedraggled clothes and looks all, oh, man, I'm doing my dead black guy shuffle. That's like the poster that they got for Native Son. I did see that while I was checking, and that book, one of his contemporaries, Richard Wright, he was mentioned right in the section we read this week, published, I think, right in the time that we're reading about in this book. Had to read that in the school. Let's see. But yeah, not easy to reject film to make all this money to take roles like this. And the last thing I'll say, well, two things. And then I'll check to see if listeners have anything else. Number one, when he gives his long kind of analysis about the workers at the film studios, that they have the power, that if they banded together, they could shut the studios down, I definitely do not think that is the case. I think the Harvey Weinsteins, the Julia Roberts, the Universal Pictures, I think they would fire them and get new folks, particularly if we're talking about the workers, if it's stopping racism, white supremacy. Now, if it's the workers uniting to get better wages for them, for their fellow white union workers in Hollywood or something like that, oh, sure, I'm sure they could do that. They have the Screenwriters Guild and all that stuff. I'm sure they could do that sort of thing to take care of themselves. But if we're talking about stopping films like what Ben Davis was having to critique him about and Marcus Garvey was having to critique him about, no, that's not going to happen at all. That's just not understanding white supremacy, racism. White, like he was talking about in that theater play, it is not going to be a mob of whites who join together with the black people to take arms to stop these sort of productions. We're not going to tolerate another Precious. We're not going to tolerate another Porgy and Bess. We're not going to tolerate another season of Blackish. That is not fixing to happen. The last thing, when he talks about Hollywood companies would not let me do The Ladder. He wanted to make a film on Joe Louis. They wouldn't let him do The Ladder because they said it would never do for a colored man to be shown knocking out a white boxer. I thought this was important for two reasons. One, every time someone references Joe Louis as the brown bomber, that is them calling him a nigger. That should be understood and processed every time as a racist slur. That's what it was at the time. They're making an explicit reference to him being not white, him being class. And talk about black and brown. I don't think Joe Louis was so-called Latina, but see what I mean with the nonsense, with the wording? Anyway, but every time they reference him as the brown bomber, that is a racist insult. And again, they're putting the violence in the word, even though he's a pugilist, that he drops bombs. And, oh, the scary black guy, brown guy, the guy here, but got this scary Negro, Joe Louis. Oh, and we certainly can't portray him knocking out people. They said the same thing. They would not show the films of Jack Johnson, which was 20 years before this. They would not show the films of Jack Johnson knocking out white heavyweight champions because they thought white mobs would riot not to take up arms for black people to stop lynchings, but to go lynch black people because they were upset about a nigger being shown knocking out a white man. It would not show that. So apparently that had not changed. After 20 years, nothing had really changed with that. They didn't want to see a production of Denmark Vesey. They didn't want to see a production of Joe Louis. And I'll hush here, Spike Lee said the exact same thing. I bet I can find it before we go off the air. He said the exact same thing within the last 25 years. And this was after he was a big star. He said he wanted to do a film on Joe Louis. He wanted to do a film on Jackie Robinson, and he said he couldn't get those films made. He had all this pushback, and he couldn't get the films made. He said the exact same thing 60 years later, still not interested. You still don't have a film on Joe Louis. They do have a film on Jackie Robinson, but they would not allow Spike Lee to do that. And I think that's a Disney production, if anything, and I'll hush there. Did other folks have comments or questions they wanted to share?
Yes, a little bit more reporting. I can recall earlier in the first reading where Mrs. Robeson was stating that her husband's popularity, wherever he went, had risen to the point whereas they simply pass out when they hear him sing. And I'm pretty sure she was talking about females for the most part also. And it reminded me of how the late but great Marvin Gaye was fashioned by Motown Records. That you know, and of course that's all a part of the show business that Mr. Robeson was involved in. And they also mentioned again about Old Man River, which probably is one of his most professional-wise, business-wise, his most played songs. Matter of fact, the Motown Temptations had that placed into their concert repertoire, to whereas the late, the great Melvin Franklin would sing his that particular song, because he had a world renowned bass voice also, that made it go along with the audiences, a song that was by that time was pretty old. You mentioned about him with the movies. He also was getting endorsements. He was getting endorsements that probably would be pretty lucrative to him as far as those prices were at the time. I can't remember exactly what it was for. I think it was a coffee, for a coffee, some coffee that was being sold, something like that. That Sarge that I was talking about played in the movie Soldier Story. That's the movie. So that'd be more of some sort of key to who that person actually was. I just can't think of his name, the person I was talking about. What else do I have here? Yeah, he was steady, was getting compliments about his physique. And I know that's primarily coming from the from white females, primarily. I'm pretty sure it was at that particular time, because he was, for the most part, still over in Europe. I have to imagine that eventually, very soon, in this book, he's going to do what a lot of non-white black people kept suggesting for him to do, which is to come back to this part of the world. He probably had to, because we're getting now into the mid to late 1930s, and everywhere that he has been in this book so far, during 1939 and 1945, was directly under a quote-unquote world war, including Russia, at the time. So I'm pretty sure that he is going to very soon come back to the place that is called the United States. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I did the inflation calculator. So for 1932, if you were given $100,000 today with the inflation, that would be almost $2 million. So if you want to think about it, if someone came to you and said, hey, look here, fella, I'll give you $500,000 to come do a movie.
Ooh,
where
wow.
You'll get to be a really intelligent fella, because they said he was you'll get to be a smart black guy. Lots of degrees will make you a doctor or a president, doctor. How about that? And we'll make you, you'll get to be one of President Trump's homies. It's going to be a biopic flick, and you'll be one of President Trump's friends, and it'll show you all hanging out, how you all are going to deal with the election, that sort of thing. It'll be patterned after Omarosa. What do you think? $500,000 will get you in the film. It'll be great. That's where Dr.
What about Maxwell Coffee House? That's what he was offered, $60,000 for Maxwell Coffee House.
That's a little over half. So, I mean, that'd be a little over $1 million, probably, 1.25, we'll call it. We'll do some coffee jingle. Maybe we'll get a little white girl that you can dance with, and then you can have a sip of coffee and say it energizes you and helps you, cut a jig. We'll give you $1.2 million to come do a little coffee spot. That's what I mean about – that's why I appreciated them putting that in about, hey, there's a, substantial financial cost for having some black self-respect to say, hey, I am not just going to come and be a part of some racist show like no, I'm not going to do that. No, thank you. Like, there is a cost. That might mean turning down $500,000, $1.2 million. Like, that Dr. Wells used to talk about that all the time. That's what black self-respect means.
Yes, sir.
Any other folks with questions, comments, anything stood out from the first portion of the reading?
Yes, I'd like to say one other thing. Like we mentioned before, that these race soldiers and racists have a sense of humor, because Harry Truman, he was the president during that time, and Mr. Robeson had an argument with him, you know, in his office about, I guess, the lynching that was going on. But one of the plays that Mr. Robeson was in had a theme song of Wild About Harry. And Harry Truman used that particular song in his campaign runoff when he was running for president. He's going to use the, where they let blacks, you know, we have a little coon movie every now and then, and so he's going to use that song, Wild About Harry. Now I'll mute my line.
Many victims of racism can be confused greatly in the system of white supremacy. I think Pam the Great talked about humble. That's why I say I appreciate humility. I try to exercise that myself. I know Pam the Great talked about she was fooled with Bill Clinton years ago when he was actually in office and such, you know. And many black people, hey, can put a hand up on that one. My goodness. But, I mean, that happens. That's a part of white supremacy racism, and you just try to be humble. As I said, you try to be humble and do better. That's why I think Mr. Robeson sounded the way he did in 1958. He had 20 years to rethink some of his views. With that, we will get to the second audio segment. If you had something that you did not get to share, just make a note, and we should have time to share once we conclude with our second audio segment. I will turn things back over to retired firefighter. This is Context of White Supremacy, Dr. Gerald Horns, Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary, audio segment number 2.
Robeson did not rest supine with Hollywood Mongols blocked his best efforts. While Hollywood Mongols blocked his best efforts. To the contrary, his response was to escalate his growing activism. His disappointment with Sanders of the River was countered by his growing ties with the West African Students Union in London. For example, there was a notably festive dinner dance at 62 Camden Road with Robeson as a special guest, but also featuring a star-studded lineup of future anti-colonial leaders, including Jomo Kenyatta of Kenya and Z.K. Matthews of South Africa. For the occasion, the Robesons were attired in Yoruba or Nigerian dress, a symbolic statement of where their interests were headed, and an implicit refutation of a recent era when they felt compelled to expend their income on the latest fashion from Harrods. Attendance at these student event broke all previous records, and Robeson's presence may have been a factor. There he informed the assembled that from this point forward, he would devote his life to the cause of a liberated Africa, and thus intended to tour the continent soon. Loud cheers greeted his declaration that he was funding the group and intended to continue doing so. This ovation was more than complemented by surging opinion on the continent itself. The future Nobel laureate and United Nations leader Ralph Bunche was traveling in East Africa during this era and noticed echoes of home. Paul, he wrote, "You surely are an idol of the Banta." In other words, when one mentions American Negroes, they all chorus Paul Robeson and Joe Louis. The rumor still persists that you are coming down to the Union of South Africa soon. If you do, the black folk will mob you with enthusiasm. A signal of Robeson's growing commitment to the liberation of Africa from colonialism, which endeared him to so many Africans, was indicated in 1937 when he provided a then hefty $1,500 to launch what became the most important U.S. grouping in this contested realm, the Council on African Affairs. This substance was considered splendid by one of the group's early leaders, Max Jurgen, who was to turn on Robeson viciously as the Cold War heated up. It made ironic his final comment: "I hope Essie and you are rather securely cut off from the great horde of people who are always trying to get at you." The funding of various causes had become Robeson's trademark, and said a U.S. Negro journal, meant that he was to London what Bill Robinson is to Harlem, a reference to Bojangles, a famed dancer, performer, and Hollywood star, who also known for handing out money. Paul is made a regular sucker by all the touch artists of America and Africa who work with him in pictures and in plays, including the tea room leftists who hold him up as a sort of god. In any event, this increasing Robeson identification with Africa and the left apparently did not damage a similarly growing affection for Britain, for it was then that he was importuned to stand for election for the Lord Rectorship of Edinburgh University. To that end, he was regarded by a local periodical as Aberdeen's favorite singer. In any event, this increasing Robeson identification with Africa and the left apparently did not damage a similarly growing affection for Britain, for it was then that he was importuned to stand for election for the Lord Rectorship of Edinburgh University. To that end, he was regarded by a local periodical as Aberdeen's favorite singer. Robeson's soaring popularity was inseparable from his ascending role as a prominent anti-fascist. A visiting journalist reached this conclusion after interviewing him in 1937. "The artist and social thinker in Paul Robeson have fought their last battle for mastery," said Louise Morgan, not without cause, "and the social thinker has won." She was sitting in his London flat, and it was there he informed her why the present commercial theater and films no longer interest him, as he was to insist to his dying days. "Personal success is not enough." For what was animating Robeson as they spoke were events in Abyssinia and China, which had led him beyond the racial problem to the world problem of which it is a part. Robeson was at a crossroads once more, toying with the idea of becoming a writer, which would have surprised many of the correspondents who often despaired of ever receiving a letter from him. "At the moment," said Morgan, "he is reading three novels by American Negro writers with a view to making dramatic versions of them. The theater, he feels, is at this time his most important medium. Robeson's muse was also rising. "I should like to do a chain gang sequence," he asserted. And the story of a Moroccan who, fighting in Spain, becomes conscious of the real issue and joins the government side. But as this latter comment suggested, that transformed Robeson in a manner not likely his journey to Moscow was his traveling to war-torn Spain to perform on behalf of a government then under siege by rightists backed by German and Italian fascists in a haunting presentiment of the world war that was to shortly unfold. There he sang defiant songs in Spanish that boomed over loudspeakers so that they could reach the ears of both loyalists and those seeking to destabilize the duly constituted regime. By early 1938, he remained with the British activist Charlotte Haldane, still on the front lines in Spain, soothing the seriously wounded with his singing. Speaking on the Spanish Civil War at the Albert Hall in London, Robeson made the statement that was to define the rest of his life and was to inspire artists and cultural workers for generations to come. "Every artist, every scientist must decide now where he stands. He has no alternative. There is no standing above the conflict on Olympian Heights, since the artist must take sides. He must elect to fight for freedom or slavery. I have made my choice. I had no alternative. Why? One reason was," he said, "because the history of the capitalist era is characterized by the degradation of my people. A recognition of the central role of the African slave trade." He had flown to London to speak after first considering making his address from Moscow, but changing course after Berlin pledged to jam any radio broadcast from there. Spain held pride of place in Robeson's rich storehouse of memories. "I remember," he said later, "speaking on a platform with such British eminences as Sir Richard Stafford Cripps, future Prime Minister Clement Attlee, and former Prime Minister David Lloyd George, all united in defense of Spain. I helped the Labor Party, with which he had developed a close relationship, particularly with its left wing, raise £50,000 for the besieged of Spain. He then traveled there with Attlee. It was then that he may have had the opportunity to confer with Attlee about the recent rebellion in Jamaica. Robeson was the main speaker when the Negro Welfare Association in London rallied in defense of the rebels. He also found time to appear alongside John Golan, a leader of the Young Communist League in London, at a great youth rally at Empress Hall, Earl's Court, that not only highlighted the tragic events in Spain, but similarly, unsettling developments in China and Czechoslovakia. Depredation signaled and perpetrated by militarists, Japan and Nazi Germany, respectively. His star wattage also infused the Negro Committee to Aid Spain, a U.S.-based grouping that included numerous leaders, including Ferdinand Smith of Jamaican origin and the most powerful black trade union leader in the Republic, the writer Langston Hughes, and many more. A generous gift from Robeson served to jumpstart the Negro People's Amulets for Loyalist Spain, an effort that was prompted by Patterson as the alliance of the two attorneys deepened further. Spain represented a hinge moment for Robeson. Meeting the volunteers from the U.S. and Spain, which included a complement of African Americans who played roles in the military there that they could not play at home, and witnessing their sacrifice and grit, nudged him toward returning to his homeland. He had been going back for short visits periodically, and by 1939, with the press of war on the continent, he made the decision permanent. After war arrived in Europe in 1939, Islander found London to be pretty exciting, but it was tranquil compared to Spain. Paul and I had our baptism in Madrid and Valencia, she said ruefully. So we are very much heartened and are merely interested instead of frightened. We are cautious, but our stomachs don't turn over when we hear the sirens. This was not the only transformation the couple was enduring. Near the same time, he found that at my concerts, I had noticed the most genuine and enthusiastic applause always came from the gallery. And those were the people I wanted to sing to and play to. Thus, he concluded, all my concerts in the future will have a 5 shilling top admission fee to facilitate working class attendance, which was both an artistic and political choice. Their enthusiasm buoyed his performance and the audience generally, while enriching his constituency, buoyed them as the anti-fascist struggle gained traction, mandating their enhanced participation. Surely the English were attracted to him, such as when in 1938 it was reported that a stunning 20,000 holidaymakers mobbed him at Devon's Torquay Pavilion when he arrived at a recital. They flocked to him because he was a star, because he was a symbol of an oppressed group, Africans, and their ability to fight back, thereby lifting humanity generally. They flocked to him because he spoke their languages, English and increasingly Gaelic. There were certain British leaders who were not as capable here. When not performing, Robeson could be found either listening to records as he sought to learn even more languages or reading novels, histories, books on various languages, a process that found him sporting horn-rimmed spectacles. The knowledge and insight gained also meant that he was far more informed than a typical celebrity, enhancing his popular appeal further. Though he was to be found visiting the front lines of Spain and stirring audiences in concert, Robeson's passion was learning, languages particularly. This was not an intellectual conceit, nor was it the pedantry of a dilettante, but a way to take the revolution cause to a higher level. When Robeson could speak and sing to the thousands who amassed to hear him in their language, it struck a deep chord, endearing him to those assembled and driving many more to his revolutionary banner. But the war clouds hanging over Europe would compel the Robesons to alter the comfortable status quo, even before the pivotal year that was 1939. Islander was complaining about the war threat and the fact that she had to seriously consider if it made sense to risk leaving their son Paulie in Moscow, with Moscow becoming rapidly more and more inaccessible because of German activities in Poland, Czechoslovakia, Lithuania, and Austria. With Spain and Russia on my passport, she sighed, it is very difficult for me to travel through any German territory now, and it is impossible to reach Moscow quickly, except through German-controlled territory. Even the Scandinavian air route has a stop in Hamburg. Then there was the related problem of the additional difficulty of telephoning her son, in that the lines are through Berlin or alternately through Warsaw. The Robesons were in such a dilemma that there was the possibility of our going to South America. Options were narrowing and the walls were closing in on them. As early as the fall of 1938, Miss Robeson was told bluntly that it looks as if it is going to be very unsafe in London, so you and your family had better get out quickly. It was 6 September 1939, and Miss Robeson was at her garrulous best in London, chatting about her spouse, filming hard as ever, making 8 o'clock time in the mornings, which is much more revolutionary than war for the notorious night owl. Their present abode, St. Albans Villas, Highgate Road in the Dartmouth Park near the near area of Highgate, was chosen by her with an eye for safety at the time. We had a grand shelter of our very own, right here in the house, with heavy, thick walls all about. The onset of war in Europe led to the Robesons' decision to abandon the continent, though neither he nor she could envision that this was a fatefully momentous decision. Though they were to visit London thereafter, including a lengthy stay in the late 1950s after his passport was returned, this sad and hasty adieu to London, where they thought they would reside indefinitely, delivered Robeson into the hands of his tormentors, a reality that became clear after the war that it forced them to leave in the first place to a screeching halt in 1945. Chapter 5, The Tallest Tree in Our Forest. Paul Robeson considered Proud Valley, filmed in the coal fields of Wales just before his fateful return to the U.S., his problem, his proudest accomplishment in cinema. A production of Ealing Studios, it tells an effective story of an African-American miner and singer and his relationship to the harsh reality of coal mining in Wales. The story mirrored Robeson's life in that, like his character in the movie, he too won the hearts of the working class in Wales and England, Ireland, and Scotland besides. Viewed from the perspective of Hollywood, even today, it is hard to find a film that better captures the life of a black working class man. Providing the movie with the heft of verisimilitude was the fact that local Welsh from the impoverished Rhondda Valley performed admirably alongside Robeson. There have been many films dealing with Scotland, Ireland, and England, said one critic in 1940, but never with the possible exception of The Citadel has Wales been put on the screen. This film was Robeson's parting gift to the nation that he had come to admire. This cinematic triumph gave added substance to Robeson's heartfelt words to Britain's communist newspaper on their anniversary, informing these radicals, "I have never been met with more warmth than here in Britain. I came here unshaped. Great parts of my working class roots are here." An indicator of his heartwarming experience in Wales. "The reception that I have had here," he insisted, "has passed all bounds. My whole social and political development was in England," he proclaimed in 1944, as he became as much a part of English life as I am now of American. For Robeson conceded freely, "I had planned to leave the United States for good, and I was living in London, shuttling over to Russia every summer to see my boy. I thought I saw more tolerance for Negroes abroad than I did here, speaking of the U.S., which was an accurate perception. This decision to leave the continent was taken reluctantly, given the niche he had carved in London and Europe, a decision made all the more wrenching in light of his positive experience in Wales. I will go down to Cardiff in Wales, he recalled fondly in 1965. They have a wonderful opera in London, he reflected. But the Welsh, they have their own language too. They felt that they wanted their own theater. So somewhere among the miners, before you know it, there was an opera house in Wales, the same way in Scotland, he said. Given his experience with Saunders of the River, Robeson was understandably wary about movies, even though the script for the film shot in Wales was appealing. It was a good story, said Eslander, although heaven knows what it will be like when we get through shooting. You know what films are. His admonition reached a crescendo when shortly after returning to the U.S., Robeson had a small role in Tales of Manhattan, which he saw as offensive as Saunders of the River. A distraught Robeson admitted to the New York Times that I thought I would change the picture as we went along, and I did make some headway, but his handsome paycheck could not compensate for the ugliness he witnessed on the silver screen. It turned out to the same old thing, he said angrily. The Negro solving his problem by singing his way to glory. This is very offensive to my people, he insisted. It makes the Negro childlike and innocent and is in the old plantation tradition. But Hollywood says you can't make the Negro in any other role because it won't be box office profitable in the South. The South wants its Negroes in the old style. In this multiple-part movie, Robeson appears alongside Ethel Waters as they depict a poor couple who stumble upon $40,000 with predictable stereotypes and buffoonery. Waters and Robeson, let us down, was the consensus expressed by the Harlem-based New York Amsterdam News. Under fire, Robeson denied that he had received a hefty $50,000 for his work in this debacle. It was 10% of this amount, he claimed, and by the time I paid my agents traveling and living expenses, that amounts had dwindled. He responded with an accuracy that simultaneously made it seem that he had sold out for a picture. For a pittance. He went further to endorse picketing of the film and considered joining the picketers himself. Robeson made a pledge that the industry helped him to keep promising to abandon Hollywood for good until the industry mended its ways in portrayals of Negroes. Later, he castigated Saunders of the River fumingly. That film is responsible for my present crusade as a defender of my people, he argued. It was a turning point in my public career, since I committed a faux pas which convinced me that I had failed to weigh the problems of 150 million Native Africans, he cried. I hate that picture and have tried to buy it, the rights, but because it is a tremendous movie maker, have not been able to do so. I have, however, given to charity every dollar earned from it, particularly funding scholarships or loans to African students. Robeson departed Europe on 30th September 1939, and was not to return again until August 1945, when the war on the continent had concluded. Then returning to his beloved Britain during that same period. Thus the U.S. was on the brink of war, and the ruling elite was as worried as ever about whether African Americans would remain true to the Republic in the light of the hellish Jim Crow they endured and the repeated appeals made by Tokyo for this oppressed group to follow Japan, the self-proclaimed leader of the colored races. Though Robeson's tie to Moscow is often derided, this is one-sided, akin to judging a boxing match while only focusing on one of the fighters, since it eludes that point that by far African Americans in their quest for global aid to combat Jim Crow were attracted to Japan. Even the faction herald for bringing an end to Jim Crow, that led by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., was patterned after and received sustenance from M.K. Gandhi and India. The point is that Jim Crow had such sizable support based among Euro-Americans that external support was crucial in order to erode it, and as the U.S. itself discovered from 1941 to 1945, Moscow support could be timely and effective. As a consequence of Japan's appeal to African Americans in particular, Robeson was recruited to make counter appeals via radio, urging patriotism and promising a better day if only he were heeded. Robeson's words were so moving that they were taken to the White House so that President Franklin D. Roosevelt and his activist spouse, Eleanor Roosevelt, could listen. They were very generous in their approval, Robeson was told, as were others in the listening party, including Lord and Lady Mountbatten. Miss Roosevelt was appreciative, telling Robeson that the president and I appreciate the tribute you pay to us and the valiant work you are doing in his behalf.
Context of white supremacy. And that will wrap us up. That will wrap us up for this week. We're just kind of at the early portion of Chapter 5, The Tallest Tree in Our Forest. That's where we'll pick up at for next Thursday. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If we didn't get to hear from you the first time around, you have questions, thoughts to share, definitely get your hand up. We'll make sure we include you before the broadcast concludes. Let's see. Retired firefighter Mr. Demery Four should both be with us, and I will keep an eye out for other folks who are listening in. If we missed you totally and you have a thought you'd like to share, I'll make sure we get you in as well. Retired firefighter, Mr. Demery Four, take it away. No thoughts.
Yes, ma'am.
There's Mr. Demery Four.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see what stood out to me. This time was actually, you know, I guess when Mr. Robeson was said to, you know, in the U.S. Negro Journal that funding various causes have become a trademark for Mr. Roberson meant that he was to London to what Bill Robinson is to Harlem, a reference to Bojangles, I guess the famed dancer and Hollywood star that was known for handing out money. Now, it's one thing to, you know, fund some causes. Well, I guess London was considered his home at that time, so that's where he would be making his charitable contributions. But, you know, they had already said that neither him nor his wife were good money managers. And then if you're funding a lot of causes, it's probably, you know, won't be long before, you know, you may be depleting your resources that you're going to need later on. And it looks like that, you know, his political life, he's becoming more and more engaged, visiting Spain during the Civil War. And see, even now, I guess people like, you know, when Donald Trump was downtown and Steve Harvey, I guess in the Trump powers, Steve Harvey went to visit him. You don't realize what that it looks like. You may take a picture with someone or they may set you up in a way for the news cameras to be all out there, and it looks like that you're in, you know, collaboration with this particular guy, and you were just set up. It was just a photo op. So they even in the book even have a picture, Mr. Roberson, with the over in Spain with those troops, and I, you know, I think he had the best interest, and all he thought he was, you know, helping to fight against fascism. And like you say, being an attempted parent, and during this time, who would consider leaving a child in Moscow? It's almost, you know, it's a world war getting ready to start, and you're not safe in America, but you're not safe over there either. So they was thinking about even going to South America, like somewhere you can get away from this system of racism, white supremacy. But like Mr. Fuller said, wherever you run to, they'll meet you at the shore. And the last thing is, they when they was visiting London, I think they thought they were going to end up staying there. But when the war broke out, they went back to stateside. And it said in the book that where they thought they would reside indefinitely, they delivered Roberson into the hands of his tormentors, a reality that had become clear after the war that had forced him to leave in the first place, came to a screeching halt in 1945. I'll mute my line on that, Doug.
Much obliged. They will meet you at the shore, he said. Unfortunately true. Let's see. Retired firefighter. Yes, sir.
Yes. What I find interesting in this period of time, we have the advantage of quote-unquote history, of studying history, and in reference to what was called the battle that was called World War II, we have the, you know, the books and different things, and at that particular time, Mr. Roberson and his wife and child was right in literally right in the middle of all of that, And it would have been disastrous for them if they would have left their child in Moscow. As we all know, you know, from you know, if you studied that particular history during that period of time, even in England, in London, during what they call the Blitz, and in Spain, where he would make appearances, that was the quote-unquote fascist powers, Italy and Germany, were basically using that war for practice for what we know today as World War II. And so everywhere he was in that part of the world, it was gearing up for a horrendous level of killing and destruction that the records of white people destroying things during that time, I don't think it came up to an equal yet. And he was right in the middle of it at the time. I noticed that. Because of his ability to focus and concentrate, that he was able to, him and his wife was able to make good decisions. One thing about it that's close to Mr. Fuller's counter-racist codified logic, I guess he, if not by this time or in the future, he would find out that there is no quote-unquote safe place on the planet. I can't blame him, being that, you know, from with his global, at this time, his global position and the compensation that he was getting for it, that he would be willing to move himself and his family anywhere that he would deem, him and his wife would deem, that is the most comfortable place that he can be at. I wouldn't ever criticize a non-white victim of racism, white supremacy, for having that in mind. It's a lot of interesting things that I read during that particular part of the report. What else here? Also his quote unquote what is called today his black consciousness was still coming to shape because he was always in contact, and it was very ironic that, well, basically because, you know, the African youth who ended up being heads of state, most of them were getting educated in England at the time. And what was very helpful for Mr. Robeson, as well as Mr. Robeson's influence on them, that he was able to share knowledge and understanding, you know, together with them with him and vice versa. And in turn, he was generous enough to donate funding towards their efforts. And those individuals that are like global names, mention him, you know, in that light for what he was willing to do. And I think by the author bringing these things up to someone who may not have known about Paul Robeson is something to take note of. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged again for the narration and the commentary, retired firefighter. If other folks are interested in helping out with the narration as we glide on through the text, drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. Some of the things, the very first paragraph that we started in the second audio where it said Robeson did not rest supine while Hollywood moguls blocked his best efforts. To the contrary, his response was to escalate his growing activism. I'll even stop right there on just those first two sentences. Having powerful white people blocking and obstructing what you're trying to do. I think there's a lawsuit at the Supreme Court right now about that very thing, unless I'm misinformed. 2020, 1920, white people do what they do. And I also wanted to emphasize, particularly when you have a black person like Mr. Robeson, who has been given some access to education, has been given a few nickels here and there, is allowed to travel. And that's not even counting his views. Like, even if, you know, he had nothing to say about racism, I would think racist white supremacists would be aware, like, wow, look at this here nigra. They would keep tabs on him. Particularly, you add in, like, oh, you're making these comments, talking about racism, and all the trying to weave that in your plays, talking about you want to do a play on Denmark Vesey, like, oh, yeah, it's going to be super white authorities, COINTELPRO, J. Edgar Hoover, I'm sure, hefty files, watching them all the way. Okay, so continuing. His disappointment with Sanders of the River was countered by his growing ties with West African Students Union in London. For example, there was a notably festive dinner dance at 62 Camden Road with Robeson as a special guest. And just talking about, I previously mentioned some of the folks who were there, Yomo Kenyatta and other. These are our leading figures, future presidents on the continent, who had huge influence in what they call the anti-colonial struggle of the 1940s, 50s, 60s. And even counterviolence efforts with Jomo Kenyatta, the Mau Maus in Kenya. That's extraordinary influence to be hobnobbing with these types. That's why I said traveling, man. Traveling is extraordinary. If you can get out and can refine your understanding of racism, white supremacy, you get access sometimes to different people. It's amazing who you can bump into when you leave the confines of your normal little area, and different ideas, different concepts that can be presented to you can have a huge impact on your perspective. Let's see. The funding aspect, that reminded me, I think there have been a lot of black people who find themselves in that position where they get a few nickels, maybe temporarily, from whites, and they end up trying to use some of that funding to help out black people work against racism. I think Dick Gregory was one such, the late Dick Gregory was one such person. Harry Belafonte was one such person. There have been quite a few of them who, you know, have invested funds, finances. Frequently, racists come to obstruct them as well once they see that this is how you're trying to use some of that power and influence that they have afforded you. Let's see. I thought it was interesting as well, though, the last portion of the paragraph talking about him, you know, doing all of this funding. Mr. Robeson said that Paul is made a regular sucker by all the touch artists of America and Africa who work with him in pictures and in plays, including the tea room leftists who hold him up as a sort of god. This made me think that there are probably a good number of white people who are being referenced in this section here. Who, you know, want to come and talk to Paul Robeson. Kind of the same way, if I was to make a modern comparison, the same way that whites talked about Ta-Nehisi Coates for a while, and, oh, he really gets it, and he knows what it is, and right, I read everything that he talks about, that sort of thing. When they, oh, I'm definitely down, absolutely, I get it, or they'll quote Michelle Alexander, that sort of, I can see that same type of white person. Who, oh yeah, I adore Paul Robeson, and he gets it, man. He knows what it's like. I have seen and talked to that white woman, that white man, that white child. The white identification continues throughout. Let's see. when he's talking about his visits to Spain, I was reminded of Dr. Welsing and others who've talked about the impact of the Moors, non-white people, black people conquering Spain, and how this has impacted their thinking, so-called culture, the bullfighting, and all of that. That came to mind strongly as I was reading, or yes, yeah, we were reading the section where he talked about his travels there. When he said, speaking on the Spanish Civil War at the Alberta Hall in London, Robeson made the statement that was to define the rest of his life and was to inspire artists and cultural workers for generations to come. Every artist, every scientist must decide now where he stands. No alternative. There's no standing above the conflict on Olympian Heights. Since the artist must take sides, he must elect to fight for freedom or slavery. I've made my choice. I had no alternative. Why? One reason was, he said, because the history of the capitalist era is characterized by degradation of my people, a recognition of the central role of the African slave trade. And the degradation of my people, that VGQ, we can all, I think, being explicit. And I think also the history of the capitalist era, I think, white, or it's not, I think, white people know the influence of words. If they can condition you, because they do the same thing now, they'll say that it's not really a race thing. That's what they did at KPFA. They said it's not really a race thing, it's an economics thing. Where he said, well, no, it's Firestone is dominating, which still means racism, white supremacy, what's happening in Liberia. They'll do that even now and say, well, it's not really racism, it's a class thing. You know, capitalism is the problem. It's that 1%, man. They just don't care about any of us. White, black, brown, polka dot. See, they've got that for a long time. And I think the influence, if you've been hanging around these tea room leftists, as it said in the text, and they're saying, oh, yeah, it's socialism. That's what we need to be about, man. Down with this capitalism. You know, we got to do away with this, man. Rise up. The rise of the urban proletariat. We will join with our colored brother. And that type of language and thinking will influence the way that we talk about racism, white supremacy, and as opposed to using very explicit terms to describe what's happening. It is said cliche, knowledge begins by calling things by their accurate name. Next, on 80, says, given his experience with Sanders of the River, Robeson was understandably wary about movies, even though the script for the film shot in Wales was appealing. It was a good story, said Eslanda, although heaven knows what it will be like when we get through shooting. Still the case in 2020. You know what films are. This admonition reached a crescendo when shortly after returning to the U.S., Robeson had a small role in Tales of Manhattan, which he saw as offensive as Sanders of the River. A distraught Robeson admitted to the New York Times that I thought I could change the picture as I went along, and I did make some headway, but his handsome paycheck could not compensate for the ugliness he witnessed on the screen. I think that's important because I am certain that that has happened to a lot of black people where they got involved with a project with some white people. Maybe it was even white people and other non-white people, and they had the best of intentions. Maybe they even saw from the beginning, this looks like this, you know, has some problems. Like, I don't know, these white people, but I'm going to try to make the best of this. I'm going to do, you know, my best to see if I can turn this thing and get this going in the right direction. And that doesn't happen at all. Like, I am sure. Some people even said that could have been the case with President Obama. Others, you know, felt differently. But I am sure that happens regularly where we're in a really weak position, and sometimes it can feel like you don't have any support at all in terms of just trying to get a different way of thinking or a different way of conducting business or what our agenda, where the priorities are. He's trying to get this play changed, what the lines are. Probably with Hollywood, Universal Pictures, they've been in business for a long time for a reason. They know the business of white supremacy entertainment. You're probably, if you are an actor, actress, even today, I don't know how much influence Michael B. Jordan is going to have in getting them to change that script to take this out or put this in. Those Hollywood white moguls are still pretty powerful. And he said, It turned out the same old thing, he said angrily. The Negro solving his problem by singing his way to glory. This is very offensive to my people, he insisted. It makes the Negro childlike and innocent. And lots of that even today with the help. And it's not just that the South wants its Negroes in the old style. I would add that for emphasis. Song of the South from Disney is popular outside the United States. It was not just white people in the United States, it was not just white people in the South who made the help popular. It was not just white people in the South who made Dixie popular. It's the same logic. It's not just white people in the South who practice white supremacy racism, because they'll even say that sometime. We'll get to World War II, I'm sure, at some point, when the black troops were going to Europe and being mistreated. They'll say it was the true, or they'll be specific. They'll say it was the Southern American troops, as though no other white people in the known universe practice white supremacy racism. Important to be. Knowledge begins by calling things by their proper name. Let's see. Oh, and he said it again. I said that last week. He's getting all this money, and absolutely, he's getting a few more or substantially more nickels than most of the black people in this era. This is like Depression era. He's not in the U.S. for a lot of this, but still, Depression era in the U.S. So he's making a lot more money than most of the black people at this time. But white people are still, they give it to you, and they can take it right back if they want to. And he says, even though, yeah, he did get, or it was claimed that he got $50,000. He says, by the time I paid my agents, traveling, and living expenses, that amount was gone. 2020, 1920. They just get better about doing the same thing and brag about doing so frequently. Let's see. Oh, and I super appreciate him donating the funds. I think there are certainly VGQ, but I'm sure that there are a lot of black people, you know, who would have said, hey, I was in this film, and, you know, it wasn't the best film, you know. It was The Help Part 2. All right. It wasn't the best film. Not a moment of black self-respect, but I got paid, you know. I can do some things and blah, blah, blah. Do some things for myself, do some things for my family. I am certain that many victims of racism would not have said, hey, I am so disturbed by this content and it's so messed up. I'm just going to donate all the funds. I'm not even going to keep any of the money associated with it. I'll donate it so that some black people can go to school or involve themselves in a constructive project. Like, wow, black self-respect. And again, I respect the humility to be able to say, hey, you know, I messed up. You know, I thought this is what I thought I would be capable of doing going into the project, and it didn't work out that way. And I hate, you know, what it is, and I have to accept that. Being humble. And or I didn't even understand that this was something supporting racism until my friends came and told me. I had to read Marcus Garvey's journal to find out that I had messed up. Now I understand. I'm trying to do better. A little more careful about which movies I do. Be humble. Let's see. It's pretty much at the section that we ended. I think the Roosevelts as well, I guess that's the last portion that we got into in the second audio segment. I think sometimes there will be a white president, especially whenever the next individual classified as white becomes U.S. president. If they're anything different from Donald Trump, opposing party or someone who, like, you know, doesn't like him and all that, says he's white supremacist and all that, then from time to time, they will have a white person who's supposed to be a not racist president that we should all like. Abraham Lincoln, John Kennedy, the aforementioned Billy Clinton, and like I said, whoever, you know, the next white person is after Donald Trump, I suspect, might get that same type of label. But they'll say, oh, yeah, this is a president that really liked black people. He was a friend of the coloreds. He looked out for you all every time, did as much as he could. We read Nixon's Piano for a reason. Reading is more important than watching television. Sometimes it'll be something really tacky, too, that they sat next to a black person or patted a black person on the head or ate a piece of fried chicken. Like, it'll be something really tacky that'll be like, oh, yeah, see, President such and such loves the Negro. Anything else folks need to get in before we conclude?
Yes. What was going on during that time also that was talked about in the latter half of the reading is they were using quote-unquote black personalities such as Paul Robeson to be favorable and practice quote-unquote patriotism during what ended up being called World War II. As we all know, I would say we would know that Joe Louis was probably one of the most focused black individuals at the time, you know, being the heavyweight champion of the world. That was, that was during that time, I know, probably the most prestigious sport title in the world to have. And he basically, not only did he would go on speaking engagements, he also would he also joined the military itself to put on exhibitions. Apparently, Mr. Robeson was being utilized in that way also to go around speaking, because I would imagine the racists were doing what racists do. They're pretty efficient when it comes to racist logic, and they just wanted to reassure themselves that black people will, quote-unquote, fall right in line despite their mistreatment in this part of the world. They would still fall in line. And from my studies, I found out that they were quite accurate, unfortunately. Matter of fact, they made up some sort of cliche that we're going to have victory in fighting racism here, and have victory in fighting fascism around the world, something like that. Mind you, at the same time, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was being put in jail for a quote unquote invading the draft, I believe it was at the time. And also was mentioned in the latter part of the reading was, I think, Japan had some sort of campaign trying to recruit black people to be abrasive to the quote-unquote U.S. efforts during that time, knowing that the practice of white people and practicing racism against non-white black people in this part of the world. They were attempting to take advantage of that reality. I put it that way. Maybe that content will come from white people more so than non-white people. But that was the surface attempt anyway by Japan to do so. Matter of fact, I can say in just about all of those wars that took place from World War II up until Vietnam, the same thing would go on with the with black people, with in Vietnam. The same thing happened with trying to recruit the black troops. Why are you over here? You know, that sort of thing. So it was quite popular. And most of the wars were the quote unquote United States was involved in. Thank you.
Much obliged. I forgot that footnote. That was important about the Japanese effort to kind of solicit, get to black people in the U.S. to say, hey, you know, you should not support what they're doing with the war effort. They mistreat you all, too. I thought that was important. I wanted to get more details about that. Anything else folks want to get in before we get ready to wrap things up?
Yes, I think the firefighter from Florida covered one of my points, was that the African Americans, in their quest for global aid to combat Jim Crow, was attracted to Japan because of the propaganda that Japan had released, promising, relief for the colored races. And the last thing is he understands that, you know, he's probably being watched, but it looks like that he accepts a invitation from the Attorney General, the nation's top law official, him and his wife, to a special concert. And it just happened to be the day before Germany's brutal invasion of the Soviet Union, which brought the war to a bloody level. You know, you have to be suspicious of all these, you know, the timing of all this, special invites, you know, by these certain individuals and at specific times. And it looks like it's probably a setup too. He has to watch his back during this time, especially. I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
I guess one thing I will say, much obliged, Mr. Demery, for I was thinking back about the different audio, and I was kind of critiquing myself, like, oh, man, this is we're on the third week, and this is our first time actually hearing directly from Mr. Robeson, like to hear his voice as opposed to some of the other clips that we've started the segments with. And then I was thinking back, like, what did we start with? If we didn't start with Mr. Robeson's voice, and I was, oh, we started with John Potash talking about how he was a victim of COINTELPRO and how they poisoned him and why they did this because of his stance. And I said, oh, okay, that's no error starting with that. That's a good context to keep in mind as we read. And maybe even another great reminder about the importance of being sober, because you just can never tell at what point white people think you are important enough in terms of what you're doing that it might jeopardize their system, that they need to keep tabs on you. In fact, we might need to do more than keep tabs on you. Might need to put something in your food. Might need to invite you somewhere and do even more. Like, you just never know when, you know, you are on their radar for special treatment. So be mindful of that. That's why we started with that with Mr. Robeson. And yeah, keep all of that in mind as we read and hear about his life and times and the development of his political views and response to white supremacy racism. Say it again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Let's preserve our brain computer so that we can solve the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up. Every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver, let's do everything that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. In addition to being sober, let's remain off of the cell phone. If you're going to be driving, again, just trying to take little steps to minimize problems, potential terrorism under the system. We'll be here tomorrow for Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Tune in. If you have codification, certainly tune in to share problems. Tune in. We'll share hopefully some counter-racist solutions. We'll be here Saturday for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Next week, we'll continue with the biography on Mr. Robeson. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Hope it was worthy of your Thursday evening. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.